This podcast is intended for investment professionals. You're listening to LGIM Talks, our podcast on all things investments from Legal & General Investment Management. I'm Mark Chappell. Today, we're going to talk about a really topical issue, the prospects of moving the UK from a five-day to a four-day week. Barely a week goes by without another report on the risks that automation will wipe out millions of jobs, and a four-day week has been touted as a way to both improve productivity and avoid the risks of major labour force automation. Here today to talk to us about their fascinating research on the topic are Chris Jeffrey, strategist in the asset allocation team, and Lara Bernard-Villeneuve, portfolio manager in our global bond strategies team. Thanks so much for joining us here today, guys.
Thanks, Mark. Pleasure.
Thank you, Mark.
Chris, how can we understand the policy proposal of a four-day week?
So I think you've teed it up nicely, Mark, that there is a trend towards increasing automation in the workplace, which is the subject of lots and lots of very alarmist reports about the proportion of the workforce that is going to be wiped out, 30% by 2030, 50% by 2050. You know, economists are trying to sort of engage in a game of one-upmanship for how bad this effect could be. But I think the thing that we have to be aware of is the potential for these automation trends to lead to a reduction in hours rather than necessarily a reduction in employment. Now, why do we say that? It's because one of the very clear trends in the labour market over the last 50 years, 100 years, 200 years is a move towards shorter working weeks and greater statutory rights to paid leave and paid holidays.
We work fewer hours than our parents, and our parents work fewer hours than their parents. It's been a growing trend that, you know, the 9-till-5 day.
But dramatically so, yeah. I think, is the point here. So if we were having this conversation 200 years ago, other than wearing slightly different clothes and not being in a recording studio, our standard working week would be something like 70 hours long. If we're having it 100 years ago, it would be a 55-hour standard working week. Today in the UK, the standard working week, and then it depends on how you adjust for holidays or not, is somewhere in the region of 32 hours, if you pro-rata the effect of holiday entitlements.
That's an astonishing come down over that time period of from 70 hours. I mean, the idea of working 70 hours in a week is enough to make anyone think that, well, there's no time for anything else at all at this point. But 32 hours seems quite low, Lara. How can we understand the average working week as today?
The average working week as today is the balance between the required working time, which is basically based on a 5 days week pattern, and the need for holidays, absence for like sick days, taking care of like family responsibilities, which is something of a gradual importance in a world where women are actually more and more engaged in professional life. So this time reduction that we are going to is driven by also the requirement for more personal time, for more leisure and activities outside the office hours.
If I'm understanding this right, it's a way that the world has moved up until this point and potentially is where we will be moving over time.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of drawing on a number of UK specifics here, but this is really a trend that we've seen across the developed world. Yeah. But kind of focusing in on some of the fixed points in the kind of the calendar of the last 100 years in the UK, until 1938, there was no statutory right to holiday. You know, you would get weekends off, you had no statutory right to paid holiday whatsoever. And then when it was introduced, it was 1 week. Today, the statutory right to holiday for people in the UK working on a full-time basis is 28 days. So the statute book has evolved in a way that has protected workers' rights, and there's no reason to think that it won't continue to evolve. Now, this is something which, when people kind of initially hear discussion of this, think this is a kind of policy from the radical left.
Yeah, the idea of let's change the working week, and everyone who knows the Monday to Friday weekends off of as the more traditional, excluding shift work perhaps, the traditional of you work coming on Monday, that Monday feeling, and then you're working until Friday night when you're on the weekend.
Yeah, but people who propose changing that, you know, typically we think of those as being kind of figures on the political left who are arguing for kind of, you know, the accusation is they're kind of arguing for money for nothing, effectively. Yeah. But you have, there's lots of historical precedent of figures on the left and the right calling for this. I mean, you have to go back to the 1950s and Richard Nixon you know, hardly anybody's idea of a progressive socialist, was arguing that a four-day working week was inevitable. Now, I think we should kind of clarify what we mean by this. What we don't mean by this is that we think we're actually going to move to a model in which the standard weekend becomes Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
But it's about the trade-off in everybody's lives between the hours spent at work and the hours spent out of work is likely to continue to shift in the favour of hours spent out of work.
I guess that's a way of thinking. The overly simplistic way is absolutely as you said. You say four-day week to someone and someone says, oh, so Fridays are off then, or Mondays, I'll have my long weekend, thank you so much, but pay me for full-time work. Actually, this is going back to the original way you were talking about it in terms of hours worked, and this is about finding that time, giving back that time for personal life, whatever it is you choose to do with that at a certain point in time. How can we understand the different models of four-day week then in that context of it's not a long weekend? What is it then?
Well, I'd say that distinction between the weekend and the working week is increasingly false. Mm-hmm. So already today, something like one-third of workers in the United Kingdom work on either a Saturday or a Sunday. This idea that we have that, you know, the Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, is not the experience of a large proportion of the UK population already. There's one-third who work at the weekend. You've got 8.5 million people today who work on a part-time basis out of a labour force of 30-odd million. So, yeah, the vocabulary around this can be a bit unfortunate if you kind of think about the working week and the weekend. That's just not the way that
works. That's just not how it is now. Like, people are constantly logging on, they're checking emails, but at the same time, so many people have to work on Saturdays and Sundays. That's the way that their company is structured, their time with which they are paid, for which they are paid.
This is actually an example we have seen in a New Zealand company called Perpetual Guardian. Mm-hmm. They implemented the 4 days week in 2018, and they engaged at the time with academic partners such as the University of Auckland in order to measure the outcomes and to publish results. Their model was the assigned day off, so 1 day free per week, which is different for each employee.
Each employee has 1 day off a week, but they get to choose which one it is, or they're randomly assigned it?
They have to choose which one it is, and this day is full paid. Mm-hmm. So it means that it's basically more time free and not less money.
Yep.
So the company continued to operate on a 5-business-day model, which is basically the requirement, but each employee was able to have 1 day to take care of their own leisure, families, and personal responsibilities. And at the time, the results showed a considerable increase in engagement and productivity. Employees reported a decreased stress level, and it improved greatly their work-life balance. So basically, there were no negative output to this experience.
No negative outputs to the company in terms of what the company produced, as well as employee engagement, is what we're saying.
Yes, exactly. They have been able to measure the increase in productivity, which was of 19%, which is extremely high.
Considering 19% productivity, I'm sure any company would kill to get that kind of such a huge number of productivity gains.
And it comes back to Chris' point about the fact that this is not a particularly socialist demand, because from a liberal economic point of view, we can definitely see the very positive output of a 19% increase in productivity for a country.
So Lawrence had a great example there of a particular country's day, but I think if you also think back to the historical experience, it's quite useful. So you've kind of got to step beyond thinking about this as a sort of partial measure and think about this in the round. So in the round, over the last 100 years, our working week has roughly halved. It's not the case that our incomes have halved over the last 100 years. Our income has increased in aggregate something like tenfold over that period.
To carry on with that historical analogy, as a historical point that you just made there, Chris, how did we get from this kind of 70-hour working week then, where the weekend was essentially the Sabbath, from a 6-day working week to 5-day? Can we draw parallels from going from 6 to 5 from the discussion now, from going from 5 to 4?
We can, but Laura's done a lot of work on this area, so I think she should answer that question.
So the 6 days week was the norm until the start of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. It's actually the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America who pushed to change this practice in the 1920s. The movement described itself at the time as the folks who brought you the weekend. So at the time, it was pushed by social, health and religious motives. But the parallel with modern efforts to reduce working hours are striking. Typically, at the start of the 20th century, workers in the U.S. clothing industry agreed to give up on wages demand for progress toward the 40 hours week.
Yeah.
And this is something we observe more recently in the German metal industry, which position itself with a similar demand. They are willing to postpone wage demands for progress toward the 28 hours week. So this parallel is something, it's something we can observe also on what were the concerns at the time. And typically the shorter working week was also the answer to the threat of technological unemployment. And this is something that is really a concern at the moment, as we mentioned, with automation and robotic. And we observe the exact same arguments going at the moment with artificial intelligence. So history has a great example for us on those motives, and we can see that with 100 years different, we end up facing the exact same debate.
Exactly. So you've gone from these clothes workers who are facing, you know, serious automation from automated machines, but agreeing to defer their wage increases in exchange for shorter working hours, and the German calls here for exact same reason of increased automation, but I'm willing to defer wages for a 28-hour working week, you said?
Yeah, 28 hours working week.
That's it sounds so radical, and yet it's, but put in this context, it makes so much sense from a socio-historical perspective.
Definitely.
It sounds radical, but it's, you know, the other way I think about it, it's an extrapolation of a very, very well-established historical trend. You know, and Laura's kind of spoken back to the beginning of the 20th century and the this phrase technological unemployment as being the kind of the worry. I mean, that to me, that totally resonates with the way that people discuss robotics and automation today. I mean, if you want to go back to the deep and distant past, you know, the phrase "don't be such a Luddite." You know, Luddites are people who smashed up cotton mills because they thought the cotton mills were going to put weavers out of business. You know, the idea that the idea that there has been a concern that technology is going to put everybody out of work is kind of as old as the hills.
It's
really
not anything brand new. No. And the question is how we deal
with
that.
And the question is how as a society we choose to respond to that. So the most traumatic way of responding to that is to put lots of people out of work. And that's likely to fuel quite radical political responses as that section of society which has been put out of work kind of kicks back against it. What strikes me as being the kind of least disruptive way of doing this is to spread out that adjustment in a way that it has been spread out in the past.
How can we really break down this productivity boost? What is it that about working fewer hours that allows companies or employees to be more productive?
Once again, we can come back to this example we have with Perpetual Guardians in New Zealand. Employees have been highly involved into this experience. They have been asked to take some time to think about how they could rationalize the process they are working on, and how they can make their work more efficient, how they can make the time communication, and how they can make other people's involvement in their own task more efficient. And by dedicating a sufficient time to prepare for this, they ended up having absolutely great results. They realized that the communication was rationalized between employees. They managed to rely on other employees a little bit less, which has definitely a waterfall effect. And by preparing this, employees manage to end up saying that they are less stressed in the office. So we can definitely understand this as the pressure, the individual pressure being reduced. So with a sufficient preparation, apparently people can easily reduce by 20% the time they will spend doing a task and dedicating this time to something that will make them happier and probably a bit more productive also. Because if you have better work-life balance, if your lifestyle helps you being in better health conditions and being more more dedicated to your job, when you're in, you will be more productive.
So you can use that time that you would otherwise have spent working, really taking care of yourself, which helps feed back in a positive virtual cycle into your work, and that you just perform your work better, you think about it in a much healthier way, and you're able to rationalize those tasks that would have perhaps taken a little bit longer into, well, what can I really achieve in these 4 days equivalent?
Exactly. And I think there was also something about having your mind free when you work, mm-hmm. and being really focused and dedicated to your job, and not having to think about those dozens of things you will have to do when you will come back home in the evening, or those dozens of phone calls you have to give by the end of the day, which makes your time less optimized because you will not be 100% focused on what you do.
Mm-hmm. What's your guess, Mark, at the number of unpaid hours of work that people do every week?
As in you're constantly working, as in... So,
no, sorry. So this is things that... You could outsource to somebody else, like you could outsource cleaning your house to somebody else, or you could clean it yourself.
You could
get in a taxi, or you could
could outsource dry cleaning, laundry. Yep. Oh God, the amount of hours, maybe 5, 6, 7.
Yeah, I guess that would be a reasonable guess.
Yeah,
the ONS time use data say it's 16 hours a week for men and 26 hours a week for women.
God, 26 hours a week for women.
Yeah.
God,
that's 26 hours.
That's basically another full German work week.
Yes, exactly. So that's a kind of significant time pressure that we're talking about freeing up. You kind of asked the question a little while ago about, so what is it that makes moving to shorter hours kind of productivity enhancing? Laura kind of gave a micro answer. I just kind of want to give a sort of macro answer as well, which is that when we think about the output of the economy from a macro perspective, it's about blending labour and capital.
Yeah.
And if you reduce the amount of labour in the production mix, then you increase the amount of capital. So things like when you go to the supermarket and there's now self-service checkouts, you know, that's a bit of capital deepening that reduces the amount of hours that are going into the provision of supermarket services, or however you kind of want to describe it. So it's the fact that from a macro perspective, it's the fact that there's more capital per hour worked that means that those hours are more productive. Yep. And it will take different forms in different sectors and different companies, but that's the kind of aggregate macro reason. That's the reason why, kind of from first principles, you wouldn't expect a reduction if you were to reduce hours worked by 10%, yep. you wouldn't expect output to fall by 10% because you'd get capital deepening that helps offset it. And we don't know what form that would take. Yes, and every kind of business and every industry would kind of find their own solution, but it would be exactly the kind of automation of work that people worry about. I mean, these kind of two things can fit together pretty neatly. It doesn't need to be terrifying. You know, the idea that we might all have in aggregate kind of a shorter working week sounds like a very nice outcome. Mm-hmm. The idea that 30% of us might be unemployed sounds like a horrible outcome. Yeah. So you can kind of see that the very same kind of background technological change, you can think about having very, very different kind of social, political stability mm-hmm. implications depending on how it's managed.
I'd like to move this on really to our position as Legal & General Investment Management, your position in the fixed income team and the asset allocation team, of what are the investment implications, or what would they be, from a 4-day week? Which investments are likely to benefit from a societal shift to fewer hours worked?
So the 4 days week is likely to be associated with an increasing appetite for leisure and services, as mm-hmm. we already mentioned. Typically, there is an interesting statistic is that Americans typically spend around 17% more on weekend days than on weekdays. So any shift to greater leisure will put downward pressure on saving, as income is squeezed lower mm-hmm. and spending is pushed higher. So leisure and services could greatly benefit from this. But on the other side, we have infrastructures and real estate, which is currently organized around the 5 days week pattern and is highly dependent of a model where we have futures cash flow priced into the assets, which could greatly suffer. As an example, we can mention Transport for London. They have predicted passengers' journey, which is expected to increase with London's population. If there is a fall in the number of journey across a certain period of time, mm-hmm. infrastructure will be underused, and then the cash flows expected for this will definitely be revised downward. Actually, TfL has already observed in fall in the journey number across the past 4 years. It has been probably driven by both flexible working arrangements and shorter working weeks. This trend is likely to be persistent. Mm-hmm. TfL as a monopoly situation, so they can easily just increase the price to offset the loss generated by less use of their infrastructure. Real estate office space typically would also suffer from downward pressure on demand on the already available space, for which one they have probably priced cash flow in the future that might have not included this potential switch to a shorter week.
So these are assets that very much depend on the current way of working, either continuing or increasing, as it were. So as you were saying, TfL is kind of pricing in increased commuter numbers or the same amount of commuter numbers, and if that falls, they can raise prices to counteract that. For longer real estate investments, you want these offices to be used as much as possible, and if that's going to change through changing work hours, then perhaps those investments are worth a little bit less in the future than perhaps as originally evaluated, if I've understood that correctly.
Exactly. You can't reduce the quantity. You can't reduce from a day to another the quantity of office space available. This is not a
It's always going to be the same amount of offices.
Exactly. They will still be the same number of square meters, but you might have 20% employees less on the desk. Okay. So this can definitely put a huge pressure on those two asset classes.
I mean, I imagine a company who was looking to expand to a new office 5 years down the line and perhaps looking to build can now make do with their office for that many more years. But of course, that puts pressure on the real estate sector, who would be looking to sell them that new office space, as it were.
Yeah, I think this is a specific example of a broader point. The broader point being that when you get disruption, and the disruption can be technological or it can be cultural, the companies and sectors which suffer are the ones that are asset heavy.
Yep.
So the asset heavy sectors, typically the debt heavy sectors as well, they need to try to find a way of defending their balance sheets. The sectors and companies which benefit are the disruptors, who are quite asset light, but are responding to the changes in demand patterns. Lara's identified the kind of infrastructure and real estate as being the ones which are asset heavy in this space. They're kind of leveraged to the status quo in some sense. And if the status quo changes, then they need to kind of rethink. But that principle kind of applies to utility companies thinking about evolutions in the way that electricity is provided through technological change. It applies to kind of oil extraction companies who have huge assets. Yeah, exactly, huge assets around the world. But the disruption is always bad for asset heavy sectors and asset heavy companies.
I'd like to dive a little bit back into the potential winners of this scenario of leisure and retail. So we mentioned cinemas perhaps, or restaurants. I mean, leisure spending has already increased. Would we happen to see a further increase in leisure spending, or is it more in line with where we have been?
There is definitely something that could be challenging if the reduced working hours is accompanied by reduced wage, actually. Because if people have more leisure time but no money to spend, it will not be reflected in the leisure and services and like any other sector such as retail. So there is definitely a very big variable that we have to consider from this point of view. If the reduced working time goes with at least flat wages, then it might be very positive for this specific sector.
Interesting. Anything to add on that, Chris?
I think, again, it's kind of just about the long-term trend. So what would the typical spending pattern of somebody have looked like a couple of hundred years ago? It would have been the vast majority of your income is spent on food and putting a roof over your head.
Yeah.
And if we kind of look to 20 or 30 years ago, the proportion of income that was spent on goods, so including those items, but kind of, durable goods, non-durable goods, since that point, since the 1980s, since we have kind of reliable data, the proportion spent on goods has been steadily shrinking. The proportion spent on services has been steadily increasing. Like, what do you need in order to be able to consume services? You need to be able to pay for them. You need to have the time to use them.
Yeah.
So both things kind of go together. That increased time to spend on services implies that services broadly are kind of, is going to be the sectors which benefit. But yes, this has to be an adjustment which takes place slowly to avoid the drop in nominal and real wages that Lara's spoken about. If it happens quickly, We shouldn't sugarcoat it. If it happens overnight, the whole economy, the economy will shrink.
Yeah.
If it happens over 20 years, then the effect of capital deepening will offset it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's kind of an interesting public survey run by YouGov that came out quite recently, which was kind of asked people, do you agree with the principle of a four-day working week? Unsurprisingly, two-thirds of people said yes. I mean, actually, maybe that's not unsurprising. Like, what on earth were the other one-third saying? But two-thirds of people say yes. And then if the question was refined to, do you agree with the principle if it, quote, definitely meant that the national economy would shrink and people would be worse off financially, then only one in six say yes. So this is about kind of evolution, not revolution. But that evolution is perfectly possible, it's perfectly healthy, and it reduces lots of the... And this is the kind of, I guess, for me, you kind of asked Laura the kind of investment question. For me, the big investment implication is if this trend continues, it diffuses a lot of the political risks that we might otherwise really worry about.
It goes back to the Luddite riots of today, fears about automation and the sudden, like, overnight loss of so many jobs due to automation. Chris, just to start wrapping this up, from an asset allocation perspective, you mentioned how it takes out a lot of that political risk. From a macro perspective, but also from an implementation into portfolio management perspective, how can we see, is it a case of go long on leisure if you see the hours become shorter? Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's a couple of points. One is this process is happening really slowly. So you'd kind of it would be hard to see it playing out over kind of short-term investment horizons. But if you kind of ask me what's the likely composition of large cap equity indices 30 years hence, there's going to be a lot more kind of provision of leisure and tech and less provision of kind of, you know, nuts and bolts and manufactured products. Yeah. That's one. The other one is kind of how we think about this in the context of the inflation debate. In principle, as unemployment has been dropping so rapidly over the course of the last few years, people have got more and more worried about what does that mean? Kind of inflation is around the corner. I suppose this debate is just kind of a reminder that the numbers of people is not the only kind of unit that matters. It's how much those people are choosing to work.
So the
long-term trend here is towards them working less and less. And again, that in principle adds to the inflationary pressure that you take out more of the labor supply by having people work less. In principle, that puts upward pressure on wages and prices.
But
people worry about a big structural pressure in the opposite direction from technology. So for really, this is kind of, to me, this is the sort of political mirror image of that technological change, both in terms of how we think about the impact on political risks, but also in how we think about the impact on inflation. So I would say that, you know, whenever there's that debate that people say, well, inflation can never rise again because of technological change. So, well, yes, but, you know, just be aware that the response to that is a reduction in the labour supply. So it's going to mean, it's likely to mean upward pressure on wages.
Exactly. It ignores the potential consequences of that massive technological disruption.
Yes. So these kind of like the yin and the yang.
It's a very concise way of putting it, Chris. Thank you. Lara, from a fixed income standpoint, how would you approach this issue in the portfolio management?
So on top of the sector allocation that could potentially be the output of this, we would probably have all eyes focused on economic data such as productivity and definitely growth, divergence between countries, where are they on the ongoing to this potential 4 days pattern, which could help with productivity and therefore fuel the sovereigns. So we would have all eyes on the economic indicators, trying to see how this is actually translated into macro numbers, and we would probably do a bit of a shift on the sector allocation in our portfolios to reflect, as we said, the potential threat that it could represent for companies that are heavily exposed with very expensive assets.
For debt-laden companies within that infrastructure. So to kind of create a summary out of this, I feel like with the right conditions, a four-day week can have immense benefits for people through increased labour force participation, engagement, more time to spend on leisure. But it and therefore the economy, as you were saying, Chris, but it has to be done in the right way. It can't be done overnight where there'll be such an immediate cut. And it's really part of this long-term trend with technological automation leading to the just reduced need to work quite so many hours for the same output, if I've understood that right correctly.
Couldn't have said it better.
Thank you so much for joining us here today, Chris.
Thanks, Mark.
And thank you for being here today, Lara.
Thanks, Mark.
If you'd like to read more about Chris and Lara's fascinating research on the topic, we've linked to their article in the episode show notes. Thanks so much to our wonderful production team and our amazing producer, Holly McNulty. Listen again next week for more Elgium Talks. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.